In a time where it doesn't seem like anybody is able to disagree well, how do we learn to disagree with each other better? We discuss this and more with special guest Dr. John Inazu on this episode of The Overthinkers. Hello, thinking people's thinking people. Welcome to The Overthinkers, a home for people who love to have fun thinking deeply. I'm your host, Joseph Holmes, a filmmaker, film critic, professional opinionator. And with me, as always, is my sensationally civil co-host.
Nathan Clark's an actor, author, filmmaker, and person who can almost always see both sides of an argument, for better or for worse. This is actually, believe it or not, this has actually made me more enemies than friends, being able to see both sides of the argument. And when I was young, my family accused me of just choosing the one that would be more fun to argue. So do with that what you will.
Yes. Well, and with us today is a very special guest. He is a law professor, constitutional scholar, author, and former litigator. He is the Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis, the founder of the Carver Project and the Legal Vocation Fellowship, and a senior fellow with Interfaith America, where he co-directs the New Begin Fellows. He has written and co-written multiple books, including Liberty's Refuge, Confident Pluralism, and Uncommon Ground. His latest book, Learning to Disagree, The Surprising Path to Navigating Differences with Empathy and Respect, releases April 2nd and is available for pre-order now. He is the generous, the genuine, the joyful, Dr. John Inazu. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you guys. Joseph, there's no way I'm going to be able to match your energy. So,
And there's no way we're going to be able to match your resume, so I think we're
Let's just call it a draw.
Call it a draw.
Yeah, I think so.
Well said. That's the best comeback. Thank you, Nathan. Well said. Anyway, we're very excited to have Dr. Inazu on today because we are discussing how we can learn to disagree better with each other, which is something everyone knows we love discussing on this show. But first, Nathan, if people enjoy our conversation and want to engage with more of our content and be fellow overthinkers like themselves that they can agree and disagree with, where can they go?
They can go to theoverthinkersjournal.world, where they can find out more about their hosts. And there they can send us all of their love and hate mail. They can also head over to our online private Facebook group called The Overthinkers. Excuse me, where we have almost 20,000 overthinkers just like yourself getting into great discussions about all the fun stuff we talk about here. Also, we have tons of memes, as you know, or will know. If you do enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review and sharing with a friend. It really does help us so very much.
Awesome. Everybody ready to get started?
Let's do it.
Great. So, it's not a surprise. Americans today are not happy with the state of public discourse. According to Pew Research, large majorities of Americans say that the tone and nature of political debate in the United States has become more negative in recent years, as well as less respectful, less fact-based, and less substantive. According to Oxford Academic, Americans report today three times as much fear of speaking their minds as Americans did during the heyday of McCarthyism. And this is not at all in people's heads. Real political polarization has increased, with large numbers of people holding consistent conservative or consistent liberal positions increasing, the middle disappearing. The Atlantic piece, That's It, You're Dead to Me, wrote about the growing trend for people to cut people out of their lives due to areas of disagreement. And due to how common it is to be fired for being unlikable, as the Forbes piece, How Office Politics Can Get You Fired points out, this environment makes employment feel more fragile. Several theories have been put forward as to how we got here. The Economist argued that social sorting, the tendency for people to move to be near people who agree with them, is one culprit, as well as America's two-party system that sorts people into a bi model. Sociologists Dr. Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff argued in The Canceling of the American Mind that a culture of safetyism among parents and college professors left young people unexposed to alternate viewpoints and atrophied their skills in engaging with them. Yet few people have real solid answers as to how we can reverse this trend, which clearly Americans want to do. So, Dr. Inazu, I want to get your take on how we get better at disagreeing with each other. But first, I want to ask why you think we got here and why we have such a hard time disagreeing well today.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to be with you guys. So maybe the first thing to say is a little caution against presentism, right? No, I mean, everything you said is true. It makes sense. And at the same time, polarization has been worse. We did have a civil war. I mean, the election of 1800 was no cakewalk, right? So we've had a lot of challenges in this country. And I think actually part of recovering the narrative is to remember the good as well as the bad. We have gone through a lot in this country, and in some ways we're a lot better off today than we've been. Now, having said all that, things are bad, right? And you mentioned some of them. The big sword is one of them. I think our social media tendencies are a huge part of this, where we've conditioned ourselves and habituated ourselves to be talking to each other in sound bites and to self-select or have the algorithm select for us the inputs of our news sources and worldviews. And that's all bad. and maybe too, that just the frequency of the news that we get. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, I got the news twice a day, the morning paper and maybe the evening national news if I got home in time. And now every 30 seconds, I'm getting the dopamine hits of my the inputs that are telling me how bad things are, what breaking news is. And that just does something to our minds. And then I think we can sort of all comment on the tone of political discourse that has become more shrill and more constant in all directions. So that's a lot of it. That's not all of it. There's probably more, but I think that what we're feeling, and we're all feeling this, is in some ways unsurprising when we sit back and look at what has conditioned us over the past few years.
Yeah, I agree. And I do appreciate you bringing up kind of this idea, because we hear this phrase uttered a lot now, which is we are more divided than we've ever been. And I think it's important to remember that we did have a civil war. And I'm really glad that you brought this up. But what's interesting is I think it's more of an emotion. It's something that we're feeling. And, you know, I've even, as I've said in the podcast before, I'm really trying to curb my habit of opening Twitter when I wake up in the morning, because it's just vitriol center and it's not good for my mental health. And I'm a mental health advocate, guys. But it really is, if you spend a lot of time on there, I think it's a good kind of microcosm of what's going on in general society, which is we're at each other's throats. We very quickly define and dismiss each other based on what we believe and kind of the tribe we fall into. This has made it kind of a really difficult thing to actually reach across any kind of aisles. And I don't just mean political. I mean this kind of different kind of aisles, because if you do, you're immediately a traitor to your group, and you're going to be kicked out of that kind of that tribe with that you find safety, who have that kind of evolutionary drive to find comfort and safety in. And I think one of the things that I see happening is something you touched on, which is kind of the algorithm effect, which is algorithms are designed to show you more and more and more of what you're already seeing. So when you log on to Twitter, when you read the news and particular kind of outlets, what you begin to understand is start piecing together the reality that you believe is going on outside. And I remember having a conversation with someone a while ago, and I mentioned some news story that was going on, and I said, "Can you believe this happened?" And he said, "What? No, I haven't heard that. That didn't happen." I said, "No, it absolutely did happen. I can show it to you right here." And it was what we ended up discovering is because of the outlets he read, they weren't going to report this particular news story. No, I'm not going to tell you which news story this was. I'll let you guess. But I think this happens on every side in every group. But what this ultimately does is it informs our reality about the world. And so what you have is you have multiple groups of people with different realities. And there's a safety inside those groups. And you don't want to leave that group or even offer an olive branch to another group, because then you're going to be excommunicated from the current group that you're in, which is really, really bad for the human psyche if you kind of researched any of the evolutionary psychology stuff. But what I also noticed about when we're creating realities about how the world is, we're also creating realities about how other people are. And this is what I think is really interesting, is that when I remember, you know, because I'm a Christian guy and I went to Hollywood and that's where I live. I'm an actor. I'm on set a lot. And I remember all of the words and thoughts of people when they heard I was going to Hollywood, because, you know, I'm a good little church kid. My dad's a pastor. My mom's a writer. And you're going to that evil, secular, basically Babylon waiting for you to suck your soul and kill you. And I remember getting to hold of me like, oh my gosh, am I just going to be sucked into this abyss of sin that I've been warned about so many times, both online from the church, from leaders, and just personally. My parents got talked to, hey, you can't let your kid go to Hollywood. That's you know, secular Hollywood is a terrible place. And I remember, yeah, of course, there's some bad things. I'm not going to lie. But they weren't any worse than what I had seen in the towns that I had grown up in. And what I found is that people were very much like me here. Yeah, they didn't necessarily believe in, you know, my Christian ideal or you know, my belief system, but they were people who wanted to fall in love, wanted to make, you know, make their dreams happen, wanted to have a life and pay rent. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, there, yeah, of course, there's some dark things and bad things here, just like everywhere else. But these are pretty normal people. And what I had done as a result of all this stuff that I'd grown up with, you know, kind of this insular church context, was I had made a caricature out of people. And in meeting them, I discovered that most of that wasn't true. And when I was on set and someone found out I was a Christian, I can't tell you how many times people would say, no way, you're like so normal and nice, because they had grown up in a system that hadn't been exposed to many Christians. The only exposure they had had been built up from a caricature that had been pieced together by lots of different information, entertainment, news, whatever it might have been. And so, you know, we talk about this statistic a few times now on the podcast, which is, Joseph, you can remind me and correct me kind of what it is, but essentially that people are much more likely to be accepting of a gay person if they know a gay person, that it's the kind of not knowing that allows you to build up this caricature in your mind. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, and John, you talked about this, that we've been building up these kind of secluded communities, even online, that kind of describe who other people are, who we are, and they're not always accurate, which makes it really, really scary to actually reach across that aisle, whatever in whatever context that might be. So I think that's something that is going on now. But Joseph, I want to hear kind of your thoughts on this and kind of build off of what Dr. John and I have been saying to kind of so we talked about where this came from. Where is this going? Maybe even like, you know, if we don't fix this, and what are the things you kind of see that are happening currently?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, sort of, you guys have made a lot of interesting points. You know, I think I agree. Again, this is one of my hobby horses, John, that about, you know, hey, everyone's saying, oh, this is the worst things have ever been. It's like, no, not even close. One of the things I think is fascinating is that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, they were talking with, they anticipated the Civil War in many of their conversations. They wrote letters back and forth together. And one of the things they said is that our country can pretty much survive any of all of our disagreements unless they become demographically sorted. And so all of the people who, like, you know, are pro-slavery live in one area, and people who are anti-slavery live in another area, which lo and behold is what happened. And I think that that's one of the things, the problems with this sorting, that's both sorting in the real world and sorting digitally, where it's like, oh, all the people who believe something one way are going to live in the cities. All people who believe one way are going to live in the rural areas. And then, of course, the same things happens online, where everyone who believes one thing are going to watch or listen to one news source. Everybody, because then, you know, all of your tribe is based on who believes like you do. And the problem with that is a couple things. One is, you know, your ability to actually disagree with other people atrophies. You could create those caricatures. And so you're actually fighting a straw man. But then what you point out, Nathan, is that because your tribe is based on what you believe, you can't deviate from what you believe or you lose your tribe. And so that becomes, you know, a whole toxic cycle. And so I think that's the thing is, you know, I don't want to say that, like, you know, this leads to war or something like that, you know, again, like the Civil War. But like, that's the thing is that if you can't, but it leads to social conformity. Because it's like, okay, I can't disagree with this tribe. First of all, I wouldn't even know to disagree with them because I'm not hearing anything. But then if I was to, I can't allow myself to, because then I lose all my friends. I lose all those things that are attached to me. So I think what we're seeing right now, which is essentially political war, which is that, you know, we have to be, you know, in politics, it's about how can we impose our will on the other side because I'm not living near them. I think is kind of like the future of what we have, since we can't, you know, communicate with each other real world. So I guess I would say is, John, what would you say are the consequences that you're seeing presently for this? And then your path forward of like, okay, it's like you actually, as somebody who has dealt with disagreeing kind of as for a living, what you've seen be actual effective methods to reach across the island this way that you kind of advise for us?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the first thing I want to say is this problem is the most acute in the echo chambers that you guys have described, but the echo chambers are not everywhere, and this is important. So actually, as Nathan was talking about Hollywood, I was thinking, oh, I know that story because that's also the story of where I work and live, right? The narrative from some Christian circles is the big bad secular university is where kids go to lose their faith, right? And that is just not my experience. I'm at an elite, very non-religious university, and there are lots of good things happening here, right? And it's not a Christian place, and there are some bad things too, and I've got to deal with those. But by and large, day to day, people are being people. Teachers are teaching, students are learning, and you know, most days around here are pretty normal. People are doing normal things. And I think actually in a lot of parts of our country, people are doing normal things, and they're doing normal things alongside people who disagree with them. And where this really goes off the rails is when you find those pure echo chambers where the purity tests really come into play, which often happens online and increasingly happens in some offline spaces. But I think we ought not to, we don't want to live into a narrative that actually hasn't happened yet, right? A lot of people do normal things. A lot of people just want to watch the Super Bowl or whatever it is, right? And you know, I start to get into my political world and think everybody's, you know, talking about this particular article, and really nobody's talking about the particular article, right? People are listening to music and watching sports, and that's most of America. And that's actually probably okay. Like, we still need to have disagreement and dialogue, but it's actually a good thing that most people are still normal. Now, the echo chambers are increasing. That's a bad thing. And there are, especially in some circles, both left and right, there are those areas where I think the concerns you're naming about just the absolute purity tests and the frightening, chilling effect of speech, that's happening. And it's happening in some universities, not mine, but other, it happens in other places. So I don't want to deny the reality. But then what do you do about it? So I think the first thing is when you actually hit the echo chamber, when you're really in the purity test, no one's really even talking about disagreement anymore, right? So those people, like, that's not the audience of my book, because no one in those places is going to want to read a book about learning to disagree. They just are going to be happy not agreeing, right? Or happy doing their own thing. And those are also, I think, in a frightening sense, the people who really want to play a winner-take-all politics, right? They're not in it for compromise or living together. They're in it to win at all costs and then make the other side comply or suffer. And that's you know, that's a large part of our country, which is no small thing. But, and so this is like the positive side of the story now, finally, the there is, for the rest of us, a real opportunity, if we take it, to learn how to coexist across these deep differences that aren't going away. And that's maybe where it feels like a very long preface to get to the positive case of my book, which is there are some tools here that I have experienced as a law professor, as a litigator, that you can learn without going to law school. And you can apply them to the workplace or the neighborhood picnic or the family dinner. And these are like tried and true principles that when law is done at its best, keeps us as a society from being just a vengeful, you know, kill each other society, and we actually resolve our disputes through other means. And that's really important and really good, and I want more people to learn about it and know about it. So that's the premise of the book and where I try to go, and some examples of teaching law and living life as a lawyer.
That's amazing. And I don't want to throw it back to you real quick and put you on the spot. Can you walk us through a few of the ways, even just kind of an overview, just kind of some of the things that you think that our listeners might be able to take and they might be able to apply in their own lives that might make them more able to disagree well with people and connect with people unlike themselves, that could begin to be this answer to the vitriol we see? What are some of those themes?
Yeah, because I'll just add here, because like most of the people, like you said, like most people are spending most of their lives not talking about these things, but they also know that in their time, it's like when they're watching the Super Bowl, they know that I have people here who, if I say this one thing, it's going to set something off, and I
Yes.
want to be able to be authentically myself. So I want to be able to not hide these parts of myself. Again, I go to parties in New York all the time, and it's like I know, like, somebody says something, it's like, oh, I wish I could respond back to this, but I don't want to ruin the party, you know? And so that's kind of the environment that people are living in where that's going to come up for them. And so, you know, what are some of the tools? And, like, can you speak to those people that are saying, like, I want to be able to be authentically myself in my circles and not have politics be everything, but when it does come up, or not just politics, but anything, religion, anything, does come up, how can we engage with that part of ourselves with other people?
Yeah, great. Okay, so let me just kind of rattle off a couple ideas. One is the importance of discernment in these contexts. So sometimes you need the courage to speak, and sometimes you need the discipline not to speak. And knowing the difference there is really important. So you actually don't have to be the hero of every cocktail party, right? Sometimes you hear something and it's just probably best to let it slide, even if it bothers you or even if you have a different view. Or sometimes it's maybe better to say, let's have a different conversation over coffee in a few days rather than try to make your point then. But there are times, you're right, where you're sitting there thinking, I'm hearing this echo chamber, or I'm hearing this thoughtless caricature, and I should probably weigh in with some nuance. And so there are some tactics about this, right? When you hear someone say something like, all of those people, or this always happens, or this never happens, right? Pay attention to the adverbs. And when people overclaim, just jump in with a counterexample, right? And it's fairly easy to do this in a kind of non-hostile way. Just say, well, you know, like, that's an interesting comment you made, but in my experience, actually, I've talked to this group of people, or I know someone who was a little different than you're describing. So what do you think about that? And, you know, throw it back to them to defend the absolutist claim, which is rarely going to be actually defensible. So that's one way, you know, just kind of fight the caricatures through normal conversation. But I think a lot of times we get in these situations and we get really thin-skinned, right? And we, like, as soon as someone says something about our people, we're ready to fight the fight or represent the cause. And I just don't, like, most, we don't really need to do that. We can just kind of keep engaging and take some hits without worrying too much about ruffling feathers or having our feathers ruffled. That's one thing. Another thing, though, and this is on the very practical level, what I do and what I describe a lot in this book is from the luxury of having classroom settings where I'm with people over a period of time for repeat visits, and we're engaging with the same set of texts and conversations. And that is not real life for a lot of people. So if you're you know, listening to this and you're thinking, I really do want to learn how to disagree and practice this, then you're going to have to put some thought and time into it. And it's not going to be a TED talk, right? Or it's not going to be a 1 hour debate that's going to change your life or the way that you engage with people. It's going to be in relationship with other people over time. So set aside, I don't know, 4 or 6, do a book club, set aside 4 or 6 meetings where you're going to have time to talk and then go away and think and then come back and talk to the same people and ask maybe the same questions, but from a different perspective. And that's the kind of thing where you can really build in the savor time to follow up and think. And, you know, these are always best, I think, when they're open-ended on the back end so people can stay and linger and you have these unanticipated conversations. And that's when you can really get into the meat of this stuff. You kind of want to, like, have in your mind, how can I best replicate freshman year of college, even though I've got a busy life and that's not really possible, right? But like that late night dorm room conversation over pizza, that's the vibe you want. And other people want that too. And once you realize that, get some good food, spend a little of your own money on food for other people, and that'll be a great start. And then open it up for conversation.
That's fantastic. And I love what you're talking about, relationship. Because I have found there's this kind of thing that happens. There's this popular, like, trend on TikTok and YouTube and stuff where it's, you know, we make fun of our sibling, you know, and call them just terrible names and poke them and hit them and whatever, you know, just terrible to our sibling. But then the second someone else does that to our sibling, we're like, what are you doing? Stop that right now. And there's, like, this kind of instinct in us. And kind of what that tells me is there's a disagreement that you're allowed to have when it's built upon a relationship that has some time to grow and have that muscle beneath it. You know, I have a lot of friends that I have a very few amount of friends that over a long period of time, we built a relationship. So what I would say is a relationship has muscle to withstand different things. And there's always this kind of moment in the relationship when I know I can be more authentically myself and disagree. And by the way, me and some very close friends have huge disagreements about religion, about politics, about lifestyle, whatever it might be. But it wasn't the first thing we ever talked about. And so one of the things I might encourage people to do too is get to know that person outside of the cultural markers that we've been so trained to jump into conversations so we can evaluate whether they're a good person or a bad person, someone you should talk to or not. Learn to form a relationship with someone just based off of maybe mutual loves. What kind of movies do you like? What things do you do? You like golf or whatever it might be. Learn to actually enjoy that person and start building relationship with them. And this is not about being dishonest. As Joseph said, I think there's a real value to not having to hide what you think or you know, your beliefs. But I do think that there's you talked about kind of knowing when to talk about these things, having some discernment in what situations these conversations ought to be happening in. And I think oftentimes what we fail to do is actually build a relationship before we start kind of saying, well, this is what I think about this. And maybe, you know, that will crash your relationship, but I genuinely haven't seen that happen as much when there's been a relationship and you each know each other on a more just human level before you do these cultural markers that kind of define what tribe are you in. And I know that's kind of difficult, but I would encourage people, make form a relationship with someone and then gently open up about what you think and see if you can have those great late night dorm room discussions with them. But it's still, you're having those in the context of I like you and you like me. And, you know, we talked earlier about how important it is to break these caricatures. And the way you're going to do this is by forming relationship with people that are different than you. And I think that's such a valuable thing is don't immediately dismiss somebody because they don't agree with you. And you also maybe wait to talk about the disagreement until you actually learn to know them and connect with them as a person. But Joseph, do you have anything to kind of add on to this that you've learned in your conversations in different places and contexts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a lot of really cool things being talked about here, and you know, on the practical level and the philosophical level. On the practical level, I like, sir, how you talked to us about the two tiers. Like, where are disagreements happening? There isn't a kind of the public, like, you know, acquaintance, you know, slash stranger context where it's like somebody's, there's like not as deep a relationship where you're like, somebody is putting something out there that I find offensive. Do I actually engage? And oftentimes the answer is no, it doesn't actually matter. Have, you know, put a helmet on, as like a old Christian comedian would say, like, don't be thin skinned. Other times you can be like, oh, it's, you know, maybe this is, I don't want the culture around this to be affected by these attitudes. Maybe it's worth saying something. Again, what I do is what I typically do is what I do. If I find something is, you know, there's different tiers. Like I will say, sometimes I'll crack a joke kind of about it, you know, to keep, so it's like, oh, if, you know, somebody says something about, you know, somebody says something and I'll make a joke about it. Oftentimes, if I think it's a problem, what somebody says, I'll just do a kind of facial expression where I'm kind of like, well, it's, that looks like maybe it's more nuanced than that, because then I signal disagreement without engaging in it. So people know, oh, okay, I can't just do this. And if they want to engage, then they can engage and say, well, you disagree with that. We can have open up a conversation there. That's one thing I do, just to sort of be like, to make sure the culture of the room is not turning into an offensive direction. But like you said, is that's one tier. And that's really almost the less important tier. The other thing is, hey, how can you find people that you say, oh, I find this person, a relationship with this person valuable, but I want to be able to disagree with them. The thing is, what you do is you set aside time to have deeper conversations with them and to build a relationship of trust. And then you have those deeper conversations with them. And it's actually decently easy once you've built that trust to say, you're not going to think I'm a bad person just because I have this view. And those are the places where these conversations are going to happen. But as you said, Nathan, partly that's also going to depend on you having an openness to saying, this person has a view that's different from mine. And I'm not going to see them as a bad person automatically because of that. And sometimes picking the people to be friends with who kind of say, okay, that person is not going to think I'm a bad person just because of this, but also being brave enough to say, hey, I disagree with you on this. That doesn't mean I'm X. And so fostering that kind of attitude within yourself and inviting other people to share that attitude, both in an open context, so kind of like you're at the dinner table and or you're watching Super Bowl, but even more importantly, picking people you want to do that with in a more individual, like six people context or one-on-one context, and then investing those. Because that's the thing, can we talk about we're the overthinkers? Because this is what we love to do. We say, okay, let us meet together and talk about things and go deep. But actually developing that as a value, because even if you don't think that that's valuable in your life, it actually does deepen all your relationships to do that. But you do have to also come at this with a point where I'm going to be challenged and some of my views are going to be wrong, and you have to be open to that. There's a principle in, I think it's a Jewish context, which is arguing for the sake of heaven, which is we're arguing not so that I can be proven right, but so we both get closer to the truth of what it is. So yeah, I think having those two tiers of like, do I want to stick up for a culture of friendliness in a social context, but then also wanting to do that in interpersonal relationships and really investing in those interpersonal relationships? That's where something that I found really is important in my life as well.
Yeah, you know, one thought there too is, as you were talking, I was thinking about friendship, and I talk about this sort of the end of my book, that my deepest friends, they're certainly not just the superficial people, but they're also not only the people I only go deep with all the time, right? In other words, with your real friends, you have to have the downtime. You have to, like, sometimes you're getting together just to get a drink or just to hang out or just to do nothing. And that's really important to guard the depth of the friendships too. I mean, I have some intellectual colleagues where our only interaction is going deep, and that's great, but those aren't my deepest friends, because my deepest friends need the downtime too, and that's what relationship is.
Another thing, and we'll kind of wrap up with this, but I'm curious, because I haven't got a chance to read your book yet, but I'm curious if this is an aspect of having better conversations, is what I've noticed is that a lot of people, particularly on Twitter and in these contexts that we've talked about where so much of this vitriol and disagreement happens, is there's an assurance of their rightness. And this happens on every side in every group. And there, you know, I saw this book a while ago. I have no idea what the book is about, but I just love the title so much. And it said, "Don't Believe Everything You Think." It's a huge book. I have zero idea what the book is about. It could be terrible. So I just love the title, because that was such an interesting thing to think about myself, which is like, oh, I thought something. I generally think whatever I've thought is probably true. And that's just kind of this human thing, that this psychological thing that we do is we think if we've thought it, it must be true. But I think there's a real value, you know, in all through scripture, there's this value on humility. Is there any element and part of this learning how to talk to people and disagree better by going into a conversation? Let's say you're going to go into those conversations, by going into a conversation with, you know, holding your views lightly, meaning that you could be wrong. Is that part of a strategy in how to do this better?
Oh, totally. And especially today, when people want to hear not just what you think, but that you care about them and that you take seriously what they think, right? So the kind of old school strategy used to be, let me get just 5 minutes of your time and then I can just convince you of the truth of my claim. I'm not sure that ever really worked, but it definitely doesn't work today, right? And if you try to do that, people are just going to walk away. So yes, a vulnerability and an authenticity to your engagement that says, I want to tell you what I think, but I also actually really want to hear what you think, and to be open to that, you know, and maybe I'm wrong about some things. That's okay. Like I can be wrong and I can learn something from you. And that sort of posture, I think, is the whole ballgame here when we're trying to engage with other people.
When there's the kind of a term in acting, when you're studying acting, and what new actors will do a lot is they rehearse, you know, it'll be a scene with them and another person, and they're going to rehearse all their lines and go over the lines a million times and know exactly how they're going to say each line. And they talk about how this is something new actors do, and it really produces poor work, because you're not actually engaging or listening to the other person. You're just reciting what you already knew you were going to say in the way you were going to say it, with all the planned out beats that you had rehearsed in your house head home. But they say what creates a great acting scene is an engagement, knowing the lines, but an engagement with the other person. And Sanford Meisner, the great acting coach, said acting is listening. And so to create a great acting scene, and I would argue to create a good dialogue, even about things you disagree, you have to be listening. I love that you said that. It's this back and forth. Say what you want to say, but also be hearing what they're saying too. Engage with the person across from you. Don't just go in with monologue mindset, go in with a dialogue mindset.
It's the difference between real improv and fake improv, right? Yes. Fake improv says, yes, and let me just tell you what I was going to say anyway. And real improv does the yes, and actually absorbs what you just heard to make a slightly different point or tonal connection.
Exactly. I love that. And this is so fantastic. And Joseph, I'll let you throw in something at the last year, but is there anything else that you would say as we kind of wrap this up to our listeners who are, like Joseph has pointed out, who are feeling frustrated and they want to form these relationships or maybe be more honest in relationships or maybe not just feel this vitriol? Is there any last thing that you would kind of, an exhortation that you give them? Joseph, is there anything else that you'd add to that?
Yeah. So I'll say a couple things. First of all, you know, I think stuff that I've learned and stuff we've talked about here is, you know, first, you know, have a thick skin for people disagreeing with you. So it has to start with you. Start with your own humility about, you know, maybe I could be wrong. Start with listening, but listening before you're interacting with people. Again, one of the things I do is I read people who disagree with me a lot so that I have, you know, an understanding of what other people think, you know, even before I'm actually having interact with a person. But then when you're in the moment, you know, you can have discernment about whether it's worth speaking up or not, and then have courage to actually, okay, when it is the right time, to be able to say something and be able to do that. And then, but the most important thing is to focus on the relationship and doing these things, the context relationship. Invest most in that. Invest in the people that it's worth, because it is a long-term thing. And that you're mostly doing. So to invest most, in a sense, don't focus as much on doing it in surface level relationships. Focus more on doing it in deeper interpersonal relationships that you can learn from and other people can learn from you. So that's sort of what I've learned to do. What would you, as a last thing, John, on that?
What's our exhortation?
Well, maybe it's more of a warning than an exhortation, but yes to all of this, but if you're doing the training rules version, don't start with family. try this out with a friend first, right? For some reason, family is always harder. And I mean, and so try it out with a friend, get good at it, and then save the A game for later down the line with family.
Agreed.
That's good. Yes. People think that's level one, but you're right. That's the final boss. That's advanced calculus.
Learning how to disagree with your parents politically, that's like the ultimate. Once you did that, you've mastered it. One thing I'll add on top of this too, it just occurred to me because it's such an important topic, is I've also learned to have a lot more grace on people when I realize a lot of times they believe what they believe because of the things they've experienced, because of their personality, because of the trauma they've had. Have grace on people, even if they're wrong, even if you know they're wrong. Have a little empathy and grace, and then employ all the things we talked about today. But this has been a fantastic conversation. I want everybody to go get Dr. John's book. This is something that our culture, our society sorely needs right now. And I think it's something that you will enjoy and will help you in your life. So please go get his book, and we'll tell you more about where to get that book in just a little bit. But first, Joseph, what are we moving on to now?
Oh, such a good tee up. We are doing the blesses and curses segment of the week, where we take a work of art, media, or resource and bless it, i.e. recommend it, or curse it, i.e. diss it. So we always allow our guests to join us or abstain if they don't want to curse anything or just want to bless something. That's totally fine. We also let them pick up whether they want to go last or first. So, John, would you like to start us off or do best for last?
I'm going last, but I'll go.
Okay, yeah, cool. Good, that's very exciting. Okay, so everyone stick around so you can hear John's blessings and curses. So, yeah, Nathan, go ahead. What are you blessing and cursing today?
I actually came prepared today. I actually brought a lot with me. I'll go through the
movies. No!
Yes, I'm never prepared for the blesses and curses. I'm just like pulling up old movies I saw. But on this subject, it's something I'm really passionate about and something I really, really love. So I'm going to go. My first bless is going to be it's a short book. But it was a long essay, short book, long essay By James Baldwin, which is called Nothing Personal. And I'll tell you, it's not even necessarily anything particular that he says in the book that the reason I'm blessing this, the reason I really, really love this book, and just kind of his voice in general, is because he has this way of not, while he's talking incredibly with strong language against the evils of racism, the evils of the things that he was experiencing, that he was watching happen around him in his lifetime, he has this way of separating the person from the problem. And when he speaks about racism, he's speaking about it as a cancer that needs to be eradicated rather than a people who need to be eradicated. And I think that's such an interesting way that he kind of talks about this and that he views this, is that he sees this as something that's infecting people rather than the people being the cancer. And I think that's such a beautiful way to see humanity, is that even though he disagrees hugely, obviously, one of the preeminent writers kind of in that time about racism, the evils of, he still saw it as that was the problem. This is a cancer that needs to be solved. And he saw the humanity in people. And I think that's a really, really beautiful way. And it's something that comes through his writing that I think is really, really useful to, I think, to literally every side of every issue today. It's not the people that are your enemies, it's the things that they're dealing with. And they could be wrong, and they can be even toxic, and they can even have evil ideas, but there's still a humanity. As Christians, we believe that the image of God is on everywhere. There's a humanity that they have that we want to help that humanity be better rather than shove that humanity and dehumanize these people. And so I really, really loved reading his book, or short book, Nothing Personal. So I'm going to go on to my curses, which is really the fun part. I'm going to try to be fair here and curse a few things, but definitely off of kind of this conversation we had today about making people caricatures, so you can look or feel better about your own stances, beliefs, or self. So I'm going to first go with an old standard. I'm going to curse God's Not Dead. It is like one of the biggest Christian movies that has ever released, and I want to get behind films about faith. I really do, as someone who's in the film industry, who is a person of faith. Man, do I want to see good Christian movies. But this movie took the whole premises, an atheist professor is, spoiling the minds of these kids, and it's terrible. The way they portrayed atheists, these Christian filmmakers portrayed atheists, was such a caricature straw man. And by the way, I have lots of atheist friends. We have atheists listening to the podcast right now. They are kind. I'm not saying every single one of them, but most of them are kind, normal, interesting, thoughtful people. We disagree about something really big, but there's still this connect, they're normal people. And the way they portrayed atheists and anyone who didn't fully adhere to the ideology given in the movie, even one that I agree with, that God exists, it was so childish and unfair. And I don't think it's befitting of a good story about faith. And I think it did more harm than help when it came to the relationship between Christianity and the world. So yeah, I gotta dig that one. I'm also gonna I'm gonna jump on. So my wife and I have been going through a lot of old TV shows because we just can't get enough new episodes of something new that we enjoy. So we went back to, and I'm a huge Aaron Sorkin fan. He's a fantastic writer. I went back and watched The Newsroom. First of all, this is a fantastically acted show. Obviously, this is brilliantly written. Just entertaining, interesting, fun. And I wanted to slam my head into a brick wall the entirety of it, even though I was enjoying it. The way they paint anybody who disagrees with Sorkin's beliefs, whatever that might be, is so unbelievably unfair and caricature-like. That it was just so, come on, really? That's, you're going to make a caricature out of people that I don't think you've ever actually met one, because that's nothing what they look like. But also, the worst sin to me was how they lionized and basically sanctified anything anybody who had the right beliefs did, even if it was despicable. And so, in one scene, they will be talking about how despicable and awful the other side is for doing these things. In the next scene, they're justifying literally the main character threatening a reporter that if they release a story, he'll beat them up. And we're supposed to see this as a heroic action right after they preach to us how bad the other side was. And so this just goes to this this kind of the thing that's happening that we've talked about today, in which we've talked about in other episodes too. We justify anything we do because we're on the right side, and we caricaturize anybody who doesn't believe like we do is evil, even if they're doing something good. And so I'm sorry, Sorkin, I love you, man. You are such a good writer. And yes, I will always watch The West Wing. But as much as I enjoyed The Newsroom, I gotta curse it for that reason. I think there wasn't a reciprocity in an olive branch and a fairness brought to this story. I'm also gonna curse. Wait, no. And I had one more bless that I totally forgot. Vengeance. I don't know if you've seen Vengeance. It's a fantastic movie written by BJ Novak of The Office. It's about a New York guy, in every sense of the word, who has a podcast and goes down to Texas. And by the way, and you see how him taking him out of his bubble into another bubble, you see how he changes and sees the reality of people rather than the caricature. And it also has him do self-reflection about his own things. By the way, it doesn't, there are these movies where you take the New York guy and put him into a small town and everyone's perfect in the small town. No, it shows the good and the bad, but it's a reality rather than a caricature. And I'm not going to spoil the ending for you. It's a murder mystery, it's a podcast, but it has such good commentary on multiple cultures. And I'd love to go read, I don't actually know this, but the way he portrayed people who live in small town Texas and portrayed the people who lived in big city New York is so accurate that to me, it strikes with someone who's actually spent time with and formed relationships with people from both of these groups and actually has empathy and honesty about the particularities of these different groups. So I gotta bless Vengeance. It's a really fun one. As Joseph has pointed out, the ending's a little iffy, a little controversial, but those are my blessings and curses for the day. Joseph.
Yes, cool. No, I love Vengeance. The ending kind of ruined it for me. So again, you guys watch it and then tell us what you think of the ending. But yes, so my blessing, I'm going to try to run through these quickly. Obviously, probably the best movie I've seen that portrays people disagreeing, but showing both sides in a movie is Eye in the Sky, which is a political thriller. I've blessed this before, so definitely check it out. If you haven't already, what are you doing? I'm also going to bless recently the debate between Destiny and Ben Shapiro that was on YouTube, because I really did. And again, it was one of the best examples I've seen of people who are diametrically politically opposed, but also having a discussion that was intelligent, where they actually got at the issues. So I think if you're a person who hasn't really exposed yourself to disagreements in that way, or people disagreeing with you, regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on or cultural aisle you're on, you can be challenged by that and also see what it's like to actually intelligently deal with other people's opinions. Again, it gets testy sometimes in that debate, but it is incredibly substantive, and I really like that, the way they do that. So definitely, I'm going to bless that. Curse is really nerdy. It's a really nerdy curse, but it's something that I'm upset about years later. It's the Captain America Civil War Marvel movie. And the reason is because I am a nerd and I have read the actual comic that that's based on. And that comic actually spent time with these superheroes having a real political disagreement and showing both sides as having valid points and actually asking you to wrestle with it as well. And the movie just basically did, Iron Man's bad, Iron Man's wrong. And I was just like, I don't, it doesn't matter. Again, not just I like Iron Man, I don't want him treated that way in a movie. How dare you? But also, it's just there had an opportunity to actually model, oh, you can have heroes who actually disagree with each other so much that they come to blows. And because that's how it happens a lot of times, but instead they went for the lazy way out because they couldn't conceive of actually doing that. That came out in 2016, and I felt like that was endemic of the fact that entertainment could not figure out how to do that at that time, which, that's the culture we were in at that point and are right now in many respects. So yes, that was my blessed and curses. Okay, it's a long-awaited John Benazio, what are your blessings and curses?
I mean, first of all, I just want to compliment myself for choosing to go last because now I got a sense of the vibe here and what I can talk about.
Nice.
I can also go on for 15 minutes if I want to, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, please enlighten us. We want to hear.
No, the blessing related to what we've talked about is a talk I just heard last night from a friend of mine, Alyssa Weichbrodt, who's a professor at Covenant College, and she has a book out called Redeeming Vision: A Christian Guide to Looking at and Learning from Art. And the really interesting thing about this book is she helps you think about art you don't like and then try to figure out what you can learn from it. So that really ties into what we've been talking about, right? And I'm not someone who is particularly drawn to any art, let alone especially modern art. And so the challenge to look at something from modern art and start with, oh, I hate this, and also what can I learn from it? That's a pretty good tie-in to what we've been talking about.
Well, that's great.
So that's the blessing, redeeming vision, Alyssa White wrote. The curse, this will be a little trickier to narrate here, but I think I want to kind of curse the category of Christian art that presumes it can do really good things in the world without interacting with other resources outside of its own tradition. And it ends up just often being very bad. This is almost tied to your point, Nathan, about the God's not dead thing, right? That my friends who are artists who are also Christians but care about the craft of art, that's when the real magic happens. My friend John Hendricks is just about to come out with a new book called The Myth Makers about the friendship between Lewis and Tolkien. And he does really good stuff, and it's really good art. He's not doing Christian art. And so I think the curse, but also maybe the challenge behind the curse, is to never assume that there's some kind of purity bubble you can make stuff in, that actually the world around us has a whole lot to offer. Whatever your worldview or your perspective, engage broadly and deeply and create, and don't be afraid to create from lots of different places, and then good stuff will happen.
Yeah. Amen. Well, I'll say this, you know, that, Dallas Jenkins, I saw him give a talk, and he was talking, it's like, you know, a lot of faith-based people love Dallas Jenkins, what he's done with The Chosen, but he's always saying, you know, one of his favorite filmmakers is Quentin Tarantino, you know, or, you know, Robert Altman, or things like that, these great secular filmmakers. And so it's like, you know, you need to be interacting with the best art that's being done, not just if they're Christians, in order to make some good stuff. But yeah,
you're in good company here. Those are fantastic. And Dr. Nazu, if people like what you said today and they want to continue kind of the conversation that we've been having about how to interact with people and how to disagree well, where can they connect with you? And then where can they get a copy of your new book? And when does it come out?
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for that. So the book comes out April 2nd, and it's, you know, buy it anywhere. I wrote it with a study guide and options to interact with other people. So do that stuff too. And then I've got a weekly free Substack where I kind of, you know, muse and think about different things. And so you can find me on Substack. It's called Some Assembly Required. My academic work is on the right of assembly. So there's the connection there.
That's amazing.
Nice. Fantastic.
Everyone, go get a copy of this book. If you want to get in touch with us, go to theoverthinkersjournal.world. Go to the online group to continue these kind of discussions on Facebook called The Overthinkers. If you want to get in touch with me, go to nathanclarkson.me or search my name, Nathan Clarkson, on any of the socials, and go buy my books because I want to, you know, pay rent and eat and stuff. So, Joseph, how about you?
You can find me on any of the socials as well. You can also find my work and my culture criticism, my film criticism, book criticism at Christianity Today, Irrelevant, Religion Unplugged, Religion and Liberty, all of those good places. And also you can go to my website, josephholmstudios.com, where I have links to all of those things. And you can talk to me and tell me how smart I am, because I'm desperate for affirmation. Thank you, everybody, so much for joining us. And remember, if it's worth thinking about, it's worth overthinking about.